There's quite a few people who challenge the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin on biblical grounds, and with me today is a guest who's uniquely qualified to take a look at that. I'll be right back. Welcome, Gracious Gang, to The Gracious Guest Show. I'm Mike Creevy, the host here, your humble host of The Gracious Guest Show. And my website, thegraciousguest.org, is a great place to go and check out all of my work, you know, previous videos, interviews, all kinds of fun stuff over there, as well as some of my online teaching work and my book, other projects I've got, you know, in the works, presentations you can have me give at your parish or your event, whatever the case may be. So feel free to check out thegraciousguest.org. Well, as you are no doubt already aware, if you have frequented this channel before, and if you haven't, please subscribe, like this video, share it far and wide. I appreciate it. But I oftentimes do get into the topic of the Shroud of Turin. It's a very important and recurring topic on here. It's been enormously insightful and interesting and really profound, I think, for me personally, these conversations and having my eyes opened and finding this this family, really, of folks all around the world who I'm delighted and blessed to know and to be able to learn more about the Shroud through them and see it through their eyes, but also see, you know, where there is debate, where there is some challenges to the claims of the Shroud's authenticity, and to try to pay attention to those arguments is something that's important to me. I'm trying to learn myself. And one thing I've noticed a lot in the comments on a lot of these videos is certain claims about things related to the Shroud or aspects of the Shroud itself, things depicted on the man in the image that are somehow or another contradictory to the scriptural account, or somehow at odds with what the Bible tells us or what is revealed in the Bible about our Lord, his passion, his death. So with me today to discuss that is Father Andrew Dalton, and I have his biography here. Father Andrew, he's originally from Georgia. He's a priest of the Catholic Church. He obtained a postgraduate certificate in Shroud Studies in 2011 and became a board member of Athonia, an international center of investigation on the Shroud, in 2017. In 2018, he worked with the Shroud experts all over the world to bring a university-level studies, or to bring university-level studies to the English-speaking world. He presently teaches the Biblical Theology of the Passion of the Christ for the Science and Faith Institute, which works in collaboration with the International Center of Syndonology in Turin and the Giulio Ricci Diocesan Center of Syndonology in Rome. Father Andrew has lectured on the Shroud of Turin and the sufferings of Christ all over the world, including China, Singapore, and the Philippines, and has appeared on television in America and Italy, and I might add, in quite a few spots across YouTube, and I've linked some of that information below. You'll definitely want to check out, but for now, let's jump into my really, I think, eye-opening interview and very spiritually profound, I think, interview here. Because of what Father says, not so much what I say. So I hope you'll enjoy this. Please sit back and enjoy my interview with Father Andrew Dalton on this question: is the Shroud of Turin biblical? Check it out. We're rolling. Father Andrew Dalton, welcome to the Gracious Guest Show.
Thank you, Mike, for having me. I'm so excited for this.
Well, and it's funny, I think I reached out to you, it was a while back after, of course, when you were on Pints with Aquinas, because I think that got a lot of eyes on. I just checked, as of now, I think it's up to like 2 million views, which is impressive, you know? But it's never worked out with us before because of the time difference, but now we're in the same time zone in a strange providential moment. So, so for those, I just want to ask you to start off here. I normally do this with guests. For those who might not be up to speed, I mean, just why don't you give us at least a rough sketch kind of your background, you know, your sort of where you come from, you know, your priesthood, and especially how you got involved with the Shroud.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for that. So I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia. I was studying at Georgia Tech when I found my vocation. So I always had kind of an interest in maths and sciences and things. But when I entered the seminary, I figured that's done with, right? Now we're going to go study Latin and history and theology and things like that. And it was by accident. That was in my second year of theology when somebody invited me to a Shroud talk. So keep in mind, I had been 10 years a seminarian and I didn't know anything about the Shroud. And so when Emanuela Marinelli gave, and I don't know if you know her, but she has some 20.
I know the name, yeah.
Yeah, in fact,
Yeah.
today's her birthday, so that's
Oh, is
kind of
that
neat.
right?
Yeah, she's fantastic. She's a
Happy birthday,
powerhouse.
Marmela.
And when I heard her speak, I lost sleep that night, quite literally. I said, "How in the world do I not know about this? And many, many people need to hear about it." And so I came back for another talk a week later and met another shroud expert, Paolo Di Lazzaro, a physicist. And he knocked my socks off one more time. And then he said, "Yep, come back next week. It's going to be even better." And that was with Barry Schwartz of
Oh, wow.
the Shroud of Turin Research Project. So within the span of 2 weeks, I had met three amazing
Wow.
people that had, and Barry too, he gave a course that lasted over 2 weeks. And I was hanging out with him on his cigarette breaks and going out for pizza and picking him up from the airport. And he's a good talker. So I
Yeah.
learned a lot from Barry. And so I figured, hey, I've already gone this far. Let's just keep going. So meanwhile, I was, as a seminarian, my apostolate was to lead people through our museum. We have a Shroud Museum in Rome, and they said the best way to learn is to teach, right? And so I was constantly teaching, and I just made it a personal resolution that every time I'd lead others through the Shroud, I would learn at least one new thing, right? And so over time, I just accumulated a certain amount of knowledge about the Shroud. And I realized that, gosh, I'm uniquely situated here, just having the privilege of meeting people from America and from Italy and from Spain.
Right.
And not a lot of people have access to those voices in a way that's easy, anyway. And
Sure.
so, and then meanwhile, I was studying theology and biblical theology. And so I was bringing that to bear on this conversation of Jesus's passion, death, and resurrection until I was invited to teach for the pontifical, under the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum, we have a Science and Faith Institute. And we even have a postgraduate certificate just in Shroud studies. And so I began to teach the biblical theology of the Shroud a few years ago. And now we do that in Italian, Spanish, and French. And so it's been a privilege
Wow.
to meet wonderful people all over the world who have just taken interest in the Shroud and from every different sector that you can imagine. And I'm just privileged to know such good people and with expertise far beyond my own.
Sure. Well, and it's, I think, like you said, there's a really great opportunity here, and you have, I think, a unique insight here, an ability to kind of unpack this stuff I wanted to talk to you specifically about today, and that is this question of is the shroud biblical? And just for the viewers and listeners, what I'm kind of approaching this with is, this ministry of mine, and this is a component, obviously, my channel, we cover other things as well, and I also get a lot of views on exorcist related stuff, not surprisingly, this broadly speaking, I try to explore anything touching on wonder and awe. It's sort of an anti-reductionist ministry, because I my whole life I've hated, and it's just so sad, that attitude all around us of like just limiting everything to its parts, or just this materialist reductionist kind of impulse. And so I've always been very drawn to the sea and stargazing, and like I love fantasy and like all these kinds of things, and really embraced it. At first, when you're a kid, you're into that, and like you get a teens, you kind of have that like, oh, that's not cool. And so this just really kind of grew out of that. And I never set out to do anything on the shroud specifically, but it's such a perfect, like, I find it's such a perfect, like, locus of like all these different kinds of interests and faith and reason, of course, this dialogue. So, we've looked at a lot of different and continue to look at a lot of different angles on the shroud, but this one, I sort of, it took me by surprise, and I kept seeing it, and it shows up in the comments, pretty regularly, is, criticisms of the shroud not so much appealing to the 1988 carbon dating, right, or not appealing to other scientific, kind of questions, but a not insignificant number of people, many of whom are believers, oftentimes they're non-Catholics, will sometimes approach this as kind of an attempt to almost like debunk the Catholic faith too, I think, and so I see some of that, but I also see questions like, I'll just throw one at you, Jesus didn't have a ponytail, and the man on the shroud, like it looks like he's got a ponytail, and that's supposedly proof because it's not biblical, and they'll cite different scriptures, talking about different practices or their interpretation of that being something that, you know, the Bible says he wouldn't have had a ponytail, so therefore this couldn't be him. So that those some of those are, you know, the things that I thought we'd take a look at. And of course, we'll get later to the wording, right? For shroud versus cloths and that kind of stuff. So, but
Okay.
what would you say about that first one, you know, to those who
Okay.
might bring that one
Yeah.
up?
You remind me a little bit of an your with your question, is the shroud biblical? And then the example that you cite, we do need to clarify our terminology there and understand, like, well, what do we mean when we say is X biblical or not? I have a friend of mine, theologian by the name of Matt Levering, who wrote a book, coincidentally, on the Reformation. And his thesis statement is rather, it's let's say it's the bar is not so high when he says, look, I can show you that these areas of Catholic teaching are not unbiblical, right? Which is a little less than saying, right, in the positive, like, just to be, because I think sometimes the assumption is that there's no room for a particular interpretation, given what the Bible says. And he goes on to show, actually, there is room for this thesis, even if we can't go all the way to prove in a kind of syllogistic way, what dogma or what doctrine or what insight into the shroud you might have. So I think that's one starting place. I think I can easily defend that the shroud is not unbiblical, right? So that on the first part. And then, so in other words, it's at least compatible with the affirmations of the Bible. And not only that, I would go so far as to say that these are mutually illuminating, that we have, on the one hand, we have the scriptures which bear witness, right? These are witnesses. Like we say, the gospel according to Matthew, according to Mark, according to, and they're telling different stories, but they can be harmonized. They coincide to point to the one Jesus. Well, what
Right, they're
if we have one
complementary.
complementary, exactly? And then we have, I think now, a fifth witness. And I think that's the best terminology for it. It's bearing witness. It's a testimony. It's a testimony of a different sort. And so what we have to do is simply gather up the data and simply look at it, observe it. What does it say? What are the minimal facts that everybody recognizes? And I think that's, if I had one thing to kind of offer as a corrective in the general atmosphere that I'm seeing in shroud talk or chatter online, is there sometimes to be this kind of fixation on the question of the authenticity of the shroud, which is a perfectly legitimate question. I'm all for it. I'm not one of those who would say, oh, dismiss that question. That's irrelevant. No, it's not. I don't think that's the case. I think it's a very relevant question. But I think perhaps a better starting point is simply, what's there? Ask the question about what can we see? What can we agree upon? Even whether those whether you think the shroud authentic or inauthentic, we ought to be able to be honest about what's the evidence, right? What is observable? What are the facts? And sadly, what's often been the case is that people point to one particular factoid in order to bring forward a kind of ideology which is dismissive of all the rest. And I just think that's not for a truth seeker. What you want to do is just like, give me everything. Give me somebody's hypothesis over there. But what is he looking at? What is he measuring? Let's put it to scrutiny and like see where the truth lies. But what I'm seeing today generally is that we have there's kind of a resurgence of interest in the shroud, kind of an uptick in creative material like your own, by the way, precisely because we're now that the 1988 carbon dating is allowed to be reconsidered, like since there's a shadow that's cast on that definitive declaration that is most definitely medieval, and yet now that's called into question even by those who would be happy to debunk the shroud. Now they're readily saying, yep, this is a matter of a scholarly consensus today that those tests were conducted in such a way that are in no way definitive. And so there's an open question. Now we're in a good place to consider all the data. So amongst the data points, as you say, is that there's long hair on the man of the shroud. I'm not sure if I would describe it so much as a ponytail. At least my envisioning of a ponytail is something
I don't think it
gathered
is. Right.
together in the that kind of looks like a horse's tail. But that
Right.
is instead we do have longish hair that goes to the let's say the bottom of the neck or something like that. But whatever those measurements are, and we can observe those. I think by my standards, at least compared to the hair that I have, it's long. But long is a relative term, right?
Yeah.
Long means longer than something else, right? That is considered short. But you have to wonder, are our standards today the those that Paul has in mind? So that's one question to consider. And the other question that I think we have to consider there is his audience and where he's writing to there in Corinth, and keeping in mind that Paul is after Jesus. And so, he sees Jesus on the road to Damascus, but they weren't contemporaries during Jesus's lifetime, right? He only meets Jesus after the resurrection. So, all of that is simply to say, take with a grain of salt these kinds of definitive statements that have a lot of presupposition behind them. Like, there's no way that Jesus could have that long hair and then Paul say it's shameful for a man to have long hair. I just think that's a rather impressive non sequitur in logic, right? That's the conclusion really doesn't flow from the premises, it seems to me.
And I don't know about this, but I did see because someone in, there was a thread that went on then, on my channel, and I just saw this before we got on here, so I haven't had a chance to source it or look it up. But I saw somebody make the claim that might be dealing more with long uncut hair versus long hair that is cut to be long. I don't know, like basically, differences between like masculine hairstyle versus feminine hairstyle, those kinds of questions that might be in play there. But
It's a good example of a kind of consideration that might shed new light on this. In other words, there's room for more than one vision of what Paul was speaking to. And I think sometimes we just assume that, the one that I have has just got to map onto the mind of Paul. And I think we should be cautious about overstating those assumptions.
Well, and I, so it's interesting too, because some people, quibble over, I don't know. Well, we might as well get to this now, I suppose, because I have my little my my I brought my interlinear Bible with me here, so I'd get some of the references right. But the there's of course the name of Othonia, which we'll get to here. But I just bookmarked it here, and some people have suggested, you go through, so Matthew 27, his account of the resurrection. Where we have Mark and Mark 15, then in Luke 23, right? So in the synoptics, we see some version of sindon used, right? Usually translated shroud or linen, right? Or I think Matthew says, was it sindona kathara, the clean linen. So there might be some descriptor, but sometimes translated linen, sometimes translated shroud. Am I understanding that right? That if you see sindon or sindona, it's in this case, that's typically the Greek term that we're carrying over as shroud.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So what's interesting in Mark, there's an instance of the word that's not in connection with Jesus's burial. In the young man, there's a young man, then the neoniskos in I suppose it's Mark 15, when Jesus is praying in the agony, right, in the Garden of Gethsemane, and this young man runs away naked. He runs away naked, right, to save his skin. He peels out of his sindone. Okay, so we're not used to thinking of the language of a tunic as a shroud, but what's significant to my mind in that particular usage is that it clearly is something big enough to cover a man's body, right? So a shroud isn't a strip, right? It's not a loincloth. It's a it's at least bigger than a shirt, I guess. So a sindon is translated shroud in the context of a burial, because
Right.
that's how English works well.
That's the function for it in that context, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's a burial linen, and it's big enough to cover the body. And so what's also significant in connection, what you mentioned Luke, because Luke's account is really interesting, because after the burial appears there, what, in verse 50? And I guess it's verse 53 that it says, then he took it down and wrapped it in a linen shroud and laid him in a rock-hewn tomb where no one had been laid. And that is the word syndone. Okay, so there he's happy to use the word that Matthew and Mark use. But then when you have the resurrection account, you have the linen cloths that are mentioned in verse 12. And there he goes to, so this is 24, is it 11 or 12? Yeah, 12 it says, but Peter rose and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen cloths by themselves. Yeah, he went
Missed that.
home wondering at what had happened. And so there we have the Othonia. So it seems to me that we have something similar where what is laid there on Friday is now discovered on Sunday. And so we can imagine that it's one and the same thing, even if we have two different words that refer to it. So to my mind, the best way to read this is that the Othonia include the syndone, that is, the linen cloths discovered on Sunday include the singular shroud that was there to wrap. It stands to reason that if it was wrapping the body on Friday, well, the wrappings discovered on Sunday are one and the same, even if we use new vocabulary.
But might it be also incorporating the how's a sudarium fit into this? Because I know there's reference to that, but I don't know if it
There
would
is.
that would be a
Yeah.
fair that might be a collective term maybe for both.
No, you might think so, but the way it's phrased, it's different than that, because if you look to John 20, what it says is in verses, let's see, this must be 7. So Simon Peter comes after the beloved disciple. He goes into the tomb and it says, he saw the Othonia, he saw the linen cloths lying and the
Oh,
sudarium
yes,
and the
Sudarium,
napkin,
yep.
which had been on his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but rolled up in a separate place. So see if we have two things there, the Othonia on the one hand, then in addition to the Othonia, the sudatium. Okay, so whereas it is true that Othonia is a generic neuter plural, so it is a collective of the linens, but in addition to that, we have the sudatium. So I think there's a better explanation for the plural, and I don't, maybe this is the right time to offer it here. Should I dive right into
Please.
that? Okay,
Yeah, let's do
so
it.
think of, let's back up a little bit. So this is the part that I think is often left out of this discussion, and reasonably so. Look, we get so much interest in John chapter 20, since that's where we get this great climactic phrase of he saw and believed, and it's in the context of seeing the Othonia. And so that we're just wrapped up in our attention of 20 that we miss chapter 19. All right, so the burial of Jesus is recounted in 38, 39, and 40. And I just want to revisit this for the sake of our listeners, because
Yes,
this is
please.
when a Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him leave. So he came and took away his body. So there's one member of the Sanhedrin that's mentioned in verse 38, and that's Joseph of Arimathea. We know this wealthy man that is the elite upper crust. We get yet another man introduced in the very next verse who's in that same category. It's Nicodemus. Nicodemus also, who had first come to him by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. That is like 75 of our pounds. And so to purchase such a thing, who can do it? Who can do it? You need a small fortune. Of course, then what comes in the next verse is the absolute key. This is what I want to underscore most. They, being Nicodemus and Joseph, they took the body of Jesus and bound it, that is, they bound the body in linen cloths with spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Okay, so there's three things at least to take note of. One is that the language of binding and what is being bound. Two things to keep inside the bindings here. They bound the body with aromatics, with spices. We know which ones these are because they were just mentioned in the previous verse, right? A hundred pounds of 100 Roman pounds of myrrh and aloes. And they do this now according to the custom. Okay, so you've got to ask the question, like, why did he mention that bit about as is the burial custom of the Jews? Like, wouldn't it be nice if we had ready at hand some source that would tell us about burial customs of Jews? And then you have to think, like, wait a minute, right here in this very gospel, we have another Jewish burial, and that was in chapter 11 with Lazarus.
Lazarus, right?
And so we have some points of connection, and we're being invited through these catch words to go reconsider those customs. And so the Jews, the rabbinical practice was to think in terms of gezerah shavah, which is a way of linking two passages that are distant in the text by means of words that are repeated, so catch words. Okay, so I just want to point out that in John chapter 11, and I won't reread the whole passage, but when Lazarus is called forth from the tomb, Jesus would say immediately, untie him, which presupposes that there was something to untie. And in fact, the text goes out of its way to mention the means by which he was tied. And this is in chapter 11, in verse 44, it says, then the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with bandages, and his face wrapped with a cloth. So he has a sudarium, he has a face cloth. There's several touch points which invite the juxtaposition and comparison of Lazarus's Jewish burial according to the custom and Jesus's Jewish burial according to the custom. But there, did you see how it mentions this word of keriai, these
Yeah, so I was just looking at that.
the linen strips, it's sometimes used in different translations. In other words, these something that binds his hand and feet, and it's a plural.
Mine says grave clothes,
Grave
which is
clothes. Okay. Yeah.
whatever.
So is
What are
that
grave clothes?
with regard to pseudodium, or in verse 44,
Kyrios.
keriais is what his hands are and feet are bound with. So it seems to me that we at least have a smaller type of strip or linen that binds hands and feet in the context of Lazarus. So one has to wonder, like, would Jesus, who is buried according to the Jewish custom, he too has a sudarium, were his hands and feet likewise bound? And I just want to point out that on the shroud, some have observed an interruption in the shroud body image in between the ankles and the kneecaps. So somewhere in the level of the shin, there's a crease. And so some have postulated that the cause for this crease is a linen that wraps around the outside of the linen shroud, something that would have kept the legs together, right? But others have suggested, some American science, that there's a depression in the beard, such that there would be a something that would keep the mouth closed, so that after rigor mortis relaxes, you know, because it's unsightly if the jaw is gaping wide open. And so maybe that strip was immediately under the chin, or maybe it was after wrapped in the long linen shroud, then from the outside bound. Or so, you know, so some of these, there's some speculation here, but what I would highlight is what John himself enunciates, right? Which is namely the spices. The spices are in the inside of the bound cloths. So the picture that I've got in my mind is that Jesus is laid to rest like on a sill, like much like in the catacombs, right? You to enter into a first century tomb like an arcosolium, you would go down a set of stairs into an antechamber, and against the back wall would be like a stone table. And then you'd lay the long cloth, remember it's 14 foot long, the shroud. You'd lay it down, put the body on top such that the back of the body is touching the shroud. And then it's so long, it wraps around the front of the face, over the chest, and over the front of the knees, etc. And so if where are these packs of aloes and myrrh? I mean, it seems to me the most likely thing is that they're in smaller packages, lining the peripheries, right? The sides of the body. And if that would also make sense of what we see on the shroud in the fact that we don't get the lateral information. We can't see, we see the front, we see the back, we don't see the sides.
On the sides,
And
right.
so it could be that the reason we don't see it is because there's 100 pounds of aloes in little packages or something lining left and right the body, and they're bound inside, maybe with chedi, right? With these strips that bind the which, if that's the case, I think there's heuristic value, that is, there's explanatory power in that picture, because you remember what John says next is he saw and believed. When he sees the burial shroud lying, that is lying flat because it's lying empty, that is to say, the body's no longer inside. But presumably, at least what I have in my imagination is, wait a minute, what happened to the aromatics? What happened to the aloe and myrrh? They're still inside. And if they're
He didn't
bound,
take him with
yeah.
him.
So there is a little bit of speculation there, but I don't think it's so far removed from the textual data. The data says that the aromatics were bound inside, and now the cloth is made to collapse such that it's lying, and that would really make any passerby, like John, who was there on Friday night, right? He was at the foot of the cross. Did he see the position, the orientation in which the man was buried? Is he now coming back and seeing it just as he saw it before, but no body, even though the rest that was bound, it's still there? And now it's just lying flat. I think that gives that at least makes sense of the affirmation that it was in light of what he saw that he believed. In other words, it wasn't despite what he saw that he believed anyway, hoping against hope or something. No, it's what he saw, when he saw it, because he saw it, the way that he saw it, that he saw and seeing believed. So those are some of the touch points that I wanted to mention.
No, absolutely. And I'm just curious. I don't know if this will work. Let me try something here quick because I want to see. I'll try a screen sharing thing here. Is this, if I can put this up, this is just, I just got this on the web. Is that showing up there?
Yeah, perfect.
So, this, I just want to ask is because I think I heard in some documentary or something, I want to say it was John Jackson who had put this out there, that, this mystery of multiple cloths, that some people bring up. And I hadn't thought of this till we were going through the word breakdown, but this what do you think about this theory, at least, that's out there, that the seam that you see right here
Right.
along the top, I'm not
The
sure if
top.
my mouse is showing up there or not. Is that showing up?
Yeah, I can't see your mouse, but I'm familiar with the
Right.
theory.
So, but for people looking at it, if you look at this, the elongated image, of course, you have on the in the middle there, kind of left of center, you see the front of the face, right of center, you see the back of the head. Right. So if you look at the top of this image, there's a seam that you can see that runs the whole length of the cloth, that like along the edge there. And I had seen again in some documentary where he had suggested that if you separate that from the cloth, right? So you got this long cloth, you're looking for something to wrap him with. If you cut it there, and it's like looks like a clean cut, and you can see that it's been restitched. And he at least showed one way that you could perform those wrappings you were just describing to hold the legs and hold the mouth. And then when you're done with it, in theory, I mean, let's say that it is the authentic shroud, this miracle happens, they want to preserve this thing, that it's not too hard to imagine stitching that back on, right? So you have the whole thing intact. The image, of course, isn't on it there, but I don't know, that was just one interesting theory I heard
It
to
is.
possibly account for that, that maybe that's it's right there in plain sight, possibly it's just been reattached,
Yeah. Yeah, I too am sympathetic to that theory. Here's another thing to consider. The image is the res is there's a corollary between the intensity of coloration on the shroud and the distance from the cloth to the body, right?
Sure.
So for example, the example I use is the tip of the nose. Since the tip of the
Yeah.
nose sticks out, and since the man is lying flat, the cloth is draped over the face in such a way that there is perfect contact with the tip of
Right,
the
direct
nose.
contact with the tip.
Exactly. But the Adam's apple is not the same, right? Because the chin sticks out. There's going to be a draping effect as the cloth moves from the chin towards the sternum, right?
Sure, yep.
And so there's distance right here. And the result on the shroud is that it's less densely colorized at the Adam's apple than it is at the tip of the nose, even though the shroud is
Huh.
monochromatic, right? Okay, so why is it then that we have the body image, both front and back, every area of the body, if there's a huge gap between let's say, the back of the knees, right?
Yeah.
If we have bending of the knees, there's quite a lot of distance. It seems that the cloth, in other words, is like hugging the body.
Yeah.
There are different now explanations of the observation. The observation is that we see the whole body. What
Right.
accommodates that? There we have difference. So on one theory, for example, they imagine that the shroud was moistened, perhaps with water, perhaps with a preliminary aloe and myrrh on the cloth, but not the full 100 pounds. Maybe just to leave the body on Friday night, in a state which was acceptable, even though they were going to come back on Sunday and do the full anointing, right, that we read about in the Gospels, where Mary
Right,
Magdalene
as they're
and the other,
returning, yep.
they're returning to do that exact job. But if that's the case, it might allow for a kind of clinging, right? Because a moistened cloth would be pasted to the body in a way that a dry cloth maybe wouldn't. So that's one possible theory.
Sure.
Like you say, it could also be the fact that there's bindings, whether they're just loops that go around somewhere at the level of the shins and maybe at the level of the beard or maybe at the level of the hands. What we don't see, however, is a kind of very close, like for example, if I were to put a cloth over both my face and both ears, you would imagine that when you open up the cloth, you would get like monkey ears, right? That would
Right,
be a,
right.
and this we don't see. It's much more like a flat, just almost like a, when I look in the mirror, what I see back is
Right,
the
right,
face, like with my ears in this way.
in
And
that proportion, yep.
so what I'm imagining is
Huh.
that these along the side is you have something there, like these other packs of aloe that allow the shroud to be, yes, pasted to front and back, but not every aspect of the side, not every corner. And so the shroud seems relatively flat and not bound in such a way that it creates lots of distortion on the body, because we don't. The body seems to be very just. We look at it like we might look at a picture of a man's body, as opposed to
Right.
like a something that like a Mercator map, or what do you call those maps that
Yes,
they stretch around and then
it's right.
they become disproportionate when you unfurl
Right.
them.
Right. Like Africa, like yeah, the continents don't ever really look the right size proportionally to the others and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. But I don't know of any like definitive answer to this question of this is a proposal, and what I'm presenting now, I kind of hold to it lightly. I'm just try what I'm trying to do, and what I would suggest others do is try to accommodate all the data. A lot of the pictures that I see that would re reconstruct Jesus wrapped in the tomb, which of course we don't w what we have is different. What we have is after the fact of the shroud that's discovered, but we don't see the moment, we don't see the cadaver in the cloth. And so what is the reconstruction now, working back in time, given what we do have, presumably the result of the resurrection? At least that's my stance. I'm happy to give full disclosure there. But How do we move backwards in time and imagine the moment he was laid to rest and then wrapped? And there, a lot of the pictures that I've seen don't include John 19:44, which mentions that the aloes, 100 pounds of them, are bound
Right.
with the body.
I don't think I've ever seen them depicted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that's a an oversight that, or I don't know, maybe it's intentional on the for some, and then maybe for others they just haven't noticed. They just
Yeah, because I'm thinking I want to say it's come up before, people asking, and I hadn't really looked into it, that, or looking for evidence of those, spices and aloes and this kinds of, thing,
Right.
like, or myrrh, like on the cloth itself, assuming that he was like pasted in it, you know what I mean? Or soaked in it or
Yeah.
something. And,
Yeah. And
yeah.
so if I can, I'm going to shift gears a little bit on you,
Oh,
but
please. Yeah. No, go for it.
I
Yep.
wanted to, because on the aloe and myrrh,
Yeah.
there's something there that it's just a fact amongst many that might have been left untold. And well, there it is. And so that's interesting. Let's try to make sense of it. But I think also there's the possibility of a spiritual meaning here. And I think that when we're talking about is the shroud biblical, to be honest, we've got to go there. We've got to ask, like, is there a theological intention behind
Yeah.
every aspect that's being recounted, or is it just a little factoid that we're supposed to, oh, okay, that's how it was. That's why he's telling it, because it's what took place. Some end of story.
Sure.
But I think there's also perhaps it's both, right? Perhaps what took place also has a deep theological meaning. It seems to me that myrrh definitely has connections with a kind of sacerdotal or oblative intention, right? Like myrrh accompanies those who die for sure. There's a sense of that Jesus's work on the cross was a redemptive sacrifice. Also that it was restorative, right? Aloe, it seems to me, has these associations with healing. Like we use aloe vera gel today when we get a sunburn, right? And we're familiar with that. But I wonder if it plays, because John does this kind of thing. And when he doesn't always pause to tell you, hey, and this is my theology. Let me
Yeah.
map it out for you.
That wouldn't be good storytelling.
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, like when Jesus dies, they say, or when he dies, when they pierce his side, out flows blood and water. And you could just think, like, oh, that's just a medical factoid that, when you pierce the side between the fifth and sixth rib, well, this is what happens, right? It's if the body's already dead, the kind you maybe you have a pleural effusion, maybe you have post-mortem blood that's been separated, et cetera, et cetera. But the fathers of the church, amongst them St. John Chrysostom, was happy to say, like, wait a minute, like just like Adam slept and from his side came Eve, his bride, well, so too the new Adam in the sleep of death on the tree of life, which is the cross, gives birth, as it were, to his bride, which is the church, which we enter through the waters of Christ's baptism. And how are we nourished with the life of Christ? Well, through the Eucharistic blood that we share. And so there's a sense that the church was like burgeoning from the side of the new Adam. And there we have this nuptial union. In other words, it may be that considering when we're taking up the question of is the shroud biblical, are these elements that we see on the shroud, do they correspond? We have to ask not just at the horizontal level of yes, the facts coincide, but there's a meaning that is pregnant here, and we've got to sift through that. Just being faithful to the intentions of the author means being attentive to the concerns that he has, and it may be that the text actually points in this direction. That's just an invitation to move beyond the kind of a horizontal and move into the kind of more vertical considerations of theology.
Well, and I was just saying, we just had the reading at the time of this recording, not too long ago, it was a week or so ago, about the Ezekiel, I think it's Ezekiel 47, the water flowing from the temple.
Nice.
You know, you have the drainage right from the sacrifices that would went, I think went out, if I remember correctly, to the Kidron Valley,
Yes,
you know,
all the
to
way
kind
to
of
the
like be
pit.
taken away in the stream. There's a practicality to something like that if you have a set
Okay.
animal sacrifice culture. But even
Right.
that, like this image that the Jewish people, like water and blood flowing away from the temple, from the side of the temple, like it's doesn't seem
Yeah.
like an accident to me,
Oh, no way. And if you keep reading
you
that
know?
passage, what it goes on to say is surprising because, of course, in those end chapters of Ezekiel, the author is describing the eschatological temple, right? The temple of the end times. And it doesn't coincide in all its architectural details in every way with the Jerusalem temple that the Jews would have been familiar with. In other words, it uses certain elements that are Kidron Valley, for example. I mean, that's a geographical detail that is recognizable. You know, we can locate it exactly. But then there's strange details that don't converge at all with the facts in the real world. Namely, like the water that flows from the temple, it empties into the Dead Sea, which is salt. And in other words, fresh water dies, as it were, as it becomes salty, right? Going from the highest point of, Mount Zion to the Earth's lowest point, the Dead Sea. And along the way, this water dies. I mean, that's the language that we can understand today. But if you read Ezekiel, it's just the other way around. It's the water that flows from the temple heals. The word in Hebrew is makes fresh. It heals. It heals and it makes salt waters fresh. And so it's, of course, talking about the redemption that reaches all the way down to the Dead Sea, the lowest place on earth. In other words, in the eschaton, in the New Age, the one that Jesus ushered in, the power that flows from his redemptive sacrifice is universal. It reaches to the ends of the earth. And of course, this is what we await in the parousia, is that the whole cosmos will come to share in the victory of Christ. Right now, we live in an inaugurated eschaton, but we await the consummated eschaton that redounds not only to the church, but even to the new heavens and the new earth. In other words, the cosmos itself. That's a cool reading of Ezekiel, but I think it's well read, yes, in light of Christ, the Christ event. That's what it's really alluding to.
I wanted, unfortunately, I can't, you know, stay with you for an hour on here. We only have about, you know, maybe 5 or 10 minutes here. That I want to, you know, maybe say 10, closer to 10
All
is,
right.
but I want to, I don't want to miss this opportunity to, you know, put you on the spot because I want to ask a little bit kind of in closing here about the passion, of course, and some of these details we see. There's so many, of course, to choose from, but is there, what's maybe like the, if you can pick, like the top one or two in terms of, you know, maybe even as a priest, you know, again, right now we're recording this right before Holy Week. This is going to come out right in the Easter season. What do you think for an average Catholic, you know, it might be especially good to meditate on, perhaps, you know, from what we see specifically on the shroud related to Christ's passion?
Right. Okay. This is a tough pick, but a couple things come to mind.
Sorry. Maybe like go two of them. No.
All right. So one would probably have to be the crown of thorns, and I'll speak to that in a moment. But here's another one, especially for Catholics. I think this is helpful. Do you know where does the passion begin? I know many of us think about Good Friday, and we kind of minimal or turn down the volume on Holy Thursday. But if you remember what Jesus would say, he said, just this evil generation demands a sign. It's not going to get a sign except for the sign of Jonah. Just as he
Jonah,
was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of a fish, well, so too the Son of Man. We have a kind of new Moses in Jesus. We also have a new Jonah here. Think about this. 3 days and 3 nights means Jesus, if he's risen on Sunday, that brings us back to Thursday if we're going to get 3 nights. And so that fits if you're attentive to what he says at the Last Supper. This is my body which is given. This is the cup of my blood which is poured out. This is sacrificial language. And the separation of body and blood results in death. What happens when you take the lifeblood out of the body? You die, right? And so Jesus is kind of entering into a period of death that is also spiritual. We think of death as a point, as a single moment. When was it?
Right.
Okay, 1657,
Time of
right?
death. That,
Exactly.
yeah, right.
But Jesus's death is something he enters into. In fact, as he leaves the Last Supper, where he's already liturgically anticipated the sacrifice of his death, he goes to the other side of the valley of Kidron and says, "My soul is sorrowful unto death."
Unto death,
And so
yeah.
there's a kind of spiritual dying that's happening. And as that's happening, remember, as he's praying, "Let this cup pass from me," hematidrosis. His sweat becomes like great drops of blood falling to the ground, sensitizing now the skin, the biggest organ in the body, such that the slightest touch is going to register in his body as pain. And so
Because
what
it amplifies the
it
pain receptors and
amplifies
stuff
the
for
pain,
amplified. Is that correct?
absolutely.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And so where's the first physical touch after the suffering of hematidrosis? Is that's what Luke the doctor describes there in Luke 22, 44. Well, the next physical touch is the kiss of Judas. This
That just hit me right before you said it. I was like, oh my gosh. Wow.
And we don't think of that in terms of physical violence, but that's exactly what it is, because that kiss, which ought to have been a sign of love and devotion, becomes a sign of his betrayal. And so no wonder Jesus would say to Pontius Pilate the next day, "Look, he who has handed me over to you has the greater sin." There's even a psalm, it's Psalm 55, that says, "Had my enemy betrayed me, I could bear his taunts, but it was you, my intimate friend,
My
my
intimate
close
friend.
companion." He says, like, his words are smooth as butter, but he has war in his heart. That's a picture of Judas, if ever I saw one. Even though it's written 700 or 1,000 years before Judas. But this is all an invitation to reconsider the whole of the Passion in light of Scripture, to try to understand what stands behind the physicality of the sufferings. And there's often a deep spiritual message there. And the message for me is this, that my sins are not mere infractions of a rule that is broken. No, it's a betrayal of my best friend, my Savior. It's to kiss it, like, would you betray me with a kiss? The hypocrisy of that, right? That's me, because I've received baptism and confirmation and ordination. Like, when I sin, it's important. It wounds the heart of Christ. It causes a kind of spiritual death, and that's important. This is the first move, that the first chain of events that's going to climax in crucifixion. But the first chain there, the first link in the chain, is a kiss of one of the 12. All right, so that's one
Well,
thing I
and
want
if Father, if
to.
I
Yeah.
may, just a quick side note to that too, because this is something I think is important for the listeners and the viewers to consider. Because I think like when I was a kid, or this idea of like I'm hurting Jesus or somehow, and it's like, well, he's God. Like, how could I hurt him now? And but I think it finally hit me that the time transcendent nature, right, of his mission, and how in the garden, how he's drawing to himself at that moment and what we would call a historical moment. The anticipate, I mean, the sins of those to come too, right? It's not like he did it and then everything after that's like, oh, well, you're on your own. So that something about that really started to sink in with me, not, that many years ago, when it really was starting to when I was starting to recognize that he knew I would do sin X. He's taking that to himself then. And it can give us hopefully maybe some motivation sometimes when we're at that moment of choosing a sin to maybe be like, you know what? By the grace of God, that's this sin that's being offered to me right now, that's not one of them that he had to pay for, so help me God. And you have that sense of like it's one less thing that I've done, if that makes sense, to his
I think
pain and
so.
suffering that he suffered back then. So that might be just something I'd add.
Really nice. You made me think of those three brothers that we read about in Daniel 3, that are cast into the fiery furnace. And they say, "God can save us from your fire, O king, but even if he doesn't, know this, we're not going to worship you." And I think that's the spirit, like that bold no that says, "My allegiance is to my Lord because he's good, whether he saves me or not, because he deserves that," right? And I think that's where we want to be able to bring our hearts. And we have the advantage of, from our vantage point now after the cross, knowing the love that's put on display on the cross. It's like, do we really want to disfigure the face of Jesus? Do we really want to be on the side of those who are crucifying him? Or do we want to be those who are ready to suffer with him? Because that's Paul. Paul would say, now I rejoice in my sufferings, and because I fill up what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. Like, he's actually able to identify with Christ crucified and say, I've been crucified with him. I'm going to be united to the heart of Christ, contributing in that way, not on the other side of the one driving in the nails, the ones receiving the blow as part of the body of Christ for the glorification and the redemption of the world. All right, I know we have just a few minutes, so can I
That's
go
fine,
to
but
the
you go to the crown of thorns too, you wanted to
yeah, so
mention.
let me ever
Yeah,
so
please.
briefly mention this, because
Yeah, I'll
this
go
was
for it.
so surprising, because on the shroud, what we don't see is a medieval kind of crown. You've seen like a ring that has the middle of the circle is empty, and that would leave the top of the head exposed. But it's not a wreath. Instead, it's a crown that's more like a helmet or a cap. And so it really
Almost like
caught.
it almost looks like an upside down thorny like bird's nest was one
Exactly.
I've described
That's a
it to
good way to
students,
describe
like
it.
that idea of like a cap.
I like that. I've never heard that. That's pretty good.
I neither have I. I just thought of it now.
So, the reason that it catches my attention, one, is just that if it is the work of a con artist, it's very unlikely. It's very hard to explain. Why would he deviate from this enshrined norm that always and everywhere shows a wreath of thorns? And
To
yet,
this day,
to
right?
this
Like, even though we
day,
know this about the shroud, you still
and
see
yet,
it's the
right.
circlet.
And it just goes to the strength of certain traditions, right? But what if the shroud deviates so daringly because it's just recording the cold, hard facts? Also, it's interesting to note that in Exodus, when crowns are being described, you know, it's not just a king who wears one, but a priest who wears one. And it's a hat. In fact, you can go to museums in Israel and see reconstructions of the priestly vestments. And by our standards, we call it a hat that has a little crown that is a piece right in the front that says Kadosh Ladonai on the front. And so on the one hand, it's the structure maps onto what a Jewish person might likely call in the first century a Stephanos, a crown. But beyond that, it's a crown of thorns. And this is perhaps the more important point to say, is that I went to look through the scriptures to follow the motif of thorn. And it is so rich because there you get more data points. Like in Genesis 1 and 2, where the Garden of Eden is being described, it has trees that have fruit that were good to eat. But what's not mentioned are thorns until, of course, chapter 3, when you have the original sin. And then the Lord God says to Adam, because you have listened to your wife and eaten of the fruit of which I said, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed be the ground because of you. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth, and only by the sweat of your brow shall you have food to eat. And so it seems remarkable that the consequence of sin, the fallout of the fall, if you like, is thorns and thistles. This is the picture of this curse that is upon the whole cosmos. And it's not just thorns, this cosmic curse, it's thorns and thistles. And that's the exact vocabulary that we're going to see recur in the first homily of Jesus, the first sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, there in Matthew chapter 7. Jesus would say, beware of false prophets. They are like ravenous wolves in sheep's clothing. And so you'll recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns and figs from thistles? And so what Jesus is doing there, he's saying, you're going to know them by their moral evil. He knows that thorns and thistles, in other words, are a metaphor for sin, just as he knows that good fruit is representative of the moral good that we produce, that we're called to live. And so what that means is, if you just put two and two together here, Jesus knew that he would be crowned with thorns. He called out his own passion 3 times. It wasn't surprising to him that he was going to be spat upon, that he was going to be died, that he was going to be crucified by the Pharisees, etc. He calls his shot three times. He knew that thorns and thistles were a symbol of sin. He knew he would be crowned with thorns. And so put that together, and what do you get? Without Jesus even opening his mouth, what he's saying just by the gesture of wearing a crown of thorns is, I am the sin bearer. I bear the effects of sin upon my own head. And this is of course another picture of Genesis 22. It's a rhyme, it's a typological prefiguration that we found in Genesis 22. That's where Abraham goes up the mountain with his only beloved son,
Right,
Isaac,
the binding,
the
yeah.
binding of Isaac, and there is the only beloved son walking up the mountain of sacrifice with the wood for the sacrifice, and he says, "Hey, Dad, here's the wood. Where's the lamb?" And of course, Abraham comes back to say, I think prophetically we might say, God will provide the lamb. But he doesn't, not on that day. Because if you keep reading the passage, in the very moment that Abraham's knife would descend upon poor Isaac, the angel, of course, stays his hand and says, Now that I know that you fear God, do no harm to the boy. Abraham spins around and he sees not a lamb, but a ram, and a ram with its horns wrapped in a thicket. So the head of this vicarious victim that dies in the stead of the only beloved son, it's wrapped in a thicket. And that's also significant to think of. If you know your Hebrew, the word for horn is also the word for power or might. And so it just so obviously prefigures what happens with Christ, especially if you consider that the end of Genesis 22 is a renaming of that mountain. It's no longer Mount Moriah. It's now going to be called Yahweh Yireh, which means in Hebrew, the Lord will provide. And of course, that echoes what Abraham has said. The Lord will provide what? A lamb.
Right,
A
a
lamb. And
lamb.
so think of John chapter 1 when the greatest of all prophets says, Behold the Lamb of God who
Lamb of
takes
God.
away the sins of the world. That's the beginning of John's gospel. But if you fast forward to Good Friday, Jesus on the cross, they're mocking him. Oh, you're the king? Come down, and we'll believe in you. Which is a lot like saying, if you've got divine muscles, flex, right? Like, show it. You've got might, show us your horns. And he's like, you want to see power? I'll show you power. I'll die, and on the third day rise, just as I said I would. But for the time being, my horns are wrapped in a thicket. That is to say, I'll take the blow. Give me everything. Give me your best shot. Give me all your shots. Focus all your power, all you enemies of God. What you were talking about earlier, even in the future sins come to concentrate on this one point, Jesus crucified. And he takes it. And he takes it all the way into Sheol, the land of death. But out of that darkness shines the light of victory, which is definitive. And that's how Jesus conquers his enemies. Not by duking it out in a ring, like you punch hard, but I punch harder, like horn against horn, as if it's an equal footing, Jesus and his creatures. No, Jesus is God. He vanquishes in this way, like the light vanquishes the darkness. And so the crown of thorns is an emblem of the kingship of Christ, which is not like that of Gentile kings. And so it's not like Gentile crown. It's not a crown of gold. He's the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. As a ransom for many, he lays it down. And so it's apt, it's appropriate, it's fitting that his
It's
crown be
fitting.
what it is. And so that's what I would look to, because when I was a kid and I would look to the crown, all I knew to say was, ouch. That was the extent of my spiritual life when it came to the crown. But then if you look through the lens of scripture, what you understand is something much more. He's taking upon himself the chaos, the disorder, the sin that we have perpetrated upon him, but he's doing so in such a way as to untie the knot that our original parents tied with their disobedience, and which we contribute to every time we sin. He unties it, but not from a distance, not waving a wand, not saying, abracadabra, like I forgive you by fiat, redemption takes place. No, he takes the full effects of our sins upon himself, and then from that place, with his loving obedience to the Father, undoes the effects of the first Adam. The new Adam is redeeming us through his loving obedience, and that's the path that we're to follow.
Wow. I'm afraid we're gonna have to end it there for now. We'll call it a pause. How's that? Does
Sounds
that
good.
sound?
Well, no, thanks for giving me the
So,
chance to go over
yeah.
what I think I mean when I say the shroud is biblical. These are the
We
kinds
could have
of
done
things.
a joke thing where we just had, you know, like it starts off with I just ask you that and you say yes, it is biblical. I'm like, all right, well, thank you.
The
Thank you for tuning in. So, well, thank you again, though, Father. I really appreciate your time, and I know people are going to really enjoy this. So, where can they go to learn more? I'll put links below and everything. But
Yeah,
what could they go
well,
check
listen,
out?
for those who want to go deeper, please sign up for the postgraduate certificate in Shroud Studies. We need
Sure.
people who are willing to more than dabble into these themes, but to become quite expert in them so that they can be conversant about it and real effective evangelizers. And so
Sure.
that's for those who are really eager and keen to go deep. The postgraduate certificate in Shroud Studies, look up othoniainternational.org. And there you can learn more. And of course, you can find just by Googling my name, some interviews and some parish talks that I've done if you want to go deeper into some of that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks again
All
so
right.
much. I really appreciate it, Father, and we'll see you soon.
Very good. God bless you. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. And I think, you know, again, this is just scratching the surface. There's so much more we could explore. And I definitely would love to continue the conversation with Father and with all of the guests that we've had on this program before, exploring the Shroud of Turin and many new ones to come that I have in the works that I'm excited, and you'll hear about them shortly. So just stick around. Make sure again you subscribe to this channel. Thank you guys so much for stopping by, for listening, tuning in, watching, however you're doing that. Please leave good reviews and ratings. Anything you can do to help get the word out about the Gracious Guest Show. I really appreciate it. Until next time, don't forget to wonder. Take care.